Welcome, friends. This is James Corbett. It's the 18th of April, 2013, here in Japan. And today I'm talking on the line to Jeremy Riss of AlienScientist.com, as well as his friend Matt. So, Jeremy, Matt, it's good to have you on the program today. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks. Thank you for having us.
All right. Well, it is your first time on the program, although I have had several listeners writing in to have you on to talk about some of your work, including, of course, your recent smash hit documentary, 9/11 Conspiracy Solved, Names, Connections, and Details Exposed. First, why don't you tell us a little bit about your backgrounds, where you're coming from, and why you're doing what you're doing?
All right. Well, my background is in physics. I got into studying physics after reading a book by Richard Feynman in high school, and decided I wanted to go to school and learn more about physics and science and stuff. And never realized quite what I'd be using it for, you know, to here today. But I was in a physics classroom when 9/11 happened, and saw it on TV, and it left a big impact on my life. And it's been one of the big things I've gotten into sort of since I started watching some stuff. And I knew what thermite was, and I watched a couple videos and stuff where they were debunking it, and it got me so angry. I was like you actually in the beginning, James. I used to sit there on YouTube all day and just type, you know, comments, and I'd argue with people, and then notice that they would come and spam my comments away, and all that stuff I had worked so hard to type up and do research on and get links for would just disappear. And I started making my own videos, and that those would stay up and get the message out much more clearly and effectively. And that's sort of like how I got into most of what I've done is making these videos, because I was tired of arguing with people online on different forums and stuff.
And it also prepared him, and I helped him with a lot. We spend days on end sort of debating with debunkers. And they really strengthen your blade, because they show you all the different counter arguments, and they let you really work out the best way to articulately, address them and rebuttal them.
Exactly right. Well, for the record, I've never spent my time arguing with people in YouTube comments, because I think it is just completely futile. But I'm glad to see that more people understand that the videos are more important than the comments. So I hope more people will take that attitude to heart and start spreading the information in a more effective way. But let's talk about the type of information that you've been covering on your site and on your YouTube channel, which I understand also had a bit of drama recently and was taken down for a little while. Let's talk about some of the work that you do.
All right. Well, if you want, I can fast forward to this most recent event where my YouTube channel got taken down as a result of censorship. It's a common tactic that's been used on many different channels in the past. They file a fraudulent copyright violation for one of your videos. And in order to fight that, you actually have to provide YouTube with all your personal and legal information, which I did. And they went and forwarded it to the person who made the claim, originally the party that made the claim, regardless if they have ownership of it or not. So this guy was able to use this to get all my personal information and was posting it all over online and stuff. And so anyways, it got shut down for a month, but I fought it. I fought all the allegations, and my channel is now reinstated. I'm still fighting one copyright violation so I can get my ability to upload videos longer than 15 minutes back. But it's just a lesson in sort of censorship of this was a result of me making a video where I debunked Judy Wood, who's been her I don't know if it's her, but or as much as her supporters, who have just been really virulently out there spamming this stuff all over my videos, other videos I see. It's just everywhere I come across it. And I don't know if these people are part of an organized disinformation campaign or not. I've had
just really stubborn. I mean, that's partly to jump
or
in.
Or misled, too. You know, a lot of these people don't understand science, and I lose them in any sort of scientific debate, which is, you know, really what I do. I don't touch things where I can't use science and apply, like, the scientific method to a given phenomenon. This was one of them, this whole idea of advanced energy weapons. And of course, I prefer to call them space lasers rather than directed energy weapons, but I won't get into all the technical science and stuff now because it's a little bit too much. If you have any specific questions, I can answer those.
Can I just say one thing? So, and part of the thing with the Judy Wood is that with her space lasers, it never really led to a culprit or somebody who was actually involved with the setting up. It didn't really get you towards being able to bring people to trial to get justice for what happened. It was just sort of this externalization from dealing with the people who were doing the insider trading and all these other things, you know, the Enron documents and a lot of the other stuff that was related to these events. So it kind of also pushed him, I think, towards the conspiracy solved video of really getting to the root of looking after the people and not following just an endless conversation about how it happened, but really using the evidence that we already have to start going in the direction of the culprits who may have been involved.
Exactly right. Well, that's one of the things that's always sort of frustrated me about the 9/11 truth movement for the last several years. It's become simply about the collapse of the buildings when there is obviously so much more happening on that day that do lead in productive routes. So let's talk about that video, 9/11 Conspiracy Solved. It got a lot of attention when it was first posted and continues to receive attention. So why don't we talk a little bit about that video, the genesis of that video, and the type of information that it contains?
Yeah, definitely. I had a couple of other videos that I'd released in the past went into that. I clipped up a couple of different previous videos I had done, specifically one on Kevin Ryan's series of articles called Demolition Access to the World Trade Center. And I had read that article thoroughly and started to, you know, write up scripts. And I actually had originally a 4-part series posted with almost all of the information in it on my my other channel. I think it's still posted. You can find most of them. But I took a couple of the clips out of that or the more powerful stuff and I put it together in sort of like that whole 9/11 conspiracy solved. That was actually a great name that I picked because I redid the video and changed a bunch of stuff to take out some misinformation and about the pod theory and stuff that I had included in the first version of that, the 9/11 conspiracy solved it. But actually, people that like that title, it's very attractive. It, you know, people want to see, they see that they're like names, connections, details. You know, like, oh, I want to see what this is about. So, I'm glad to provide them with, you know, the information that I got from all these other sources that I couldn't believe wasn't more mainstream. I'm like, why isn't anybody talking about this? Why aren't, you know, all the media stations, of course, you know, we can already answer that question. But I just figured I'd take that information and put it into a video form just to make it more accessible to a larger number of people. Because I see all these names and all these people and the connections, and it makes perfect sense to me. And I want to see all these people behind bars. They all need to go to prison. And they're not going to get away with this. I hate to tell you, the age of information, we got you guys beat hands down, and you're not getting away with this, period.
It's just a matter of getting the exposure out to the people and presenting it in an articulated way where, one of our conversations, we talk about core arguments versus circumstantial arguments. Right. So you might have arguments that are circumstantial that do add weight to the understanding of what went on, but by themselves, they might not hold weight, or they might even turn off some people because of the nature of how they're addressing things.
I spent a lot of time doing street actions, talking to people out in Boston, you know, where I'm from. And actually this recent marathon things just, it was, I don't know anyone personally that was affected by this event, but it was definitely a shock to me finding out the news about it. I still think it's too early. There's not enough evidence to really draw any conclusions about who was responsible. But it's the one thing I said is who benefited the most from that of anyone. And I can't see any terrorist or underground organization benefiting more than the DHS and the people.
It's
the usual.
It's going to be a clampdown on terrorism. You know, in many ways, however this event came to be, it's most likely going to be exploited towards greater police state, surveillance state even. There's a lot of stuff about the security cameras helping with finding him or would have helped find this person. You know, it's sort of this precedent to pull on emotional strings and twist into place a lot of these draconian infrastructures.
With the primary motivation for putting that whole video together, and I think I could actually go back and make a longer documentary, include more stuff. Of course, the whole beginning of that 9/11 conspiracy solved video was the stuff I got from Mark Gaffney's book, Black 9/11, which was excellent analysis of the financial aspects of 9/11. And that's really, I remind pretty much everyone I talk to about 9/11, is you have to look at it as a massive financial crime. You can't just, you know, focus on the controlled demolition or, you know, and even though the science it explains that and it's provable with science, and science doesn't lie, I still think it's important to explore these other avenues because there's so much more to be learned there. And once you kind of can see and put all these pieces together, you're like, oh my God, like these people made billions of dollars murdering people.
I mean, similar to foreign imperialism and lots of others. I mean, it's not outside of, you know, the general structure.
Well, sadly, there is a lot of money to be made in events like that, and that's why we continue to see them perpetrated, and perpetrated, obviously, by the people who stand to benefit from them, as you say. So I think that has to be our first consideration in any terror event, even ones that are spontaneous and genuine acts of terror, such that they exist. Absolutely. Who stands to benefit the most? Certainly not people in halfway around the world who are going to be the subject of bombings and drone attacks because of this. It's going to be the people who are lusting after the ability to clamp down in the name of this, and to, of course, feed into the military industrial and the intelligence industrial and all of the other complexes that make up the greater Department of Homeland Security police state that we've seen instituted as a result of this. So you've talked, obviously, a lot about 9/11 and looked at that, but you also talk about a lot of different other subjects. So why don't we start getting into some of the scientific aspects of what you talk about and the technology that you talk about on your website, Alien Scientist?
All right. Well, most of the stuff is, you know, technologies that I found online that pertain to, you know, various things. Invisibility, for example, technology and invisibility is cutting edge. It's really coming out on the market now, where we're able to build things that are invisible to the visible spectrum, and complete invisibility, holographics technology. I don't necessarily agree with any of the theories that these technologies were used on 9/11, and I always keep them compartmentalized and separate. In fact, I made that Alien Scientist channel specifically because I wanted to cover those topics, but I didn't want them to be connected with the 9/11 stuff, because too many people, if you talk about those things, then they're like, they can't focus and they get distracted. And I just thought it was not a good idea because... So I made the Alien Scientist channel separate from a lot of the 9/11 research that I've done. And it actually turns out that alien and UFO and those kind of conspiracies and stuff are a lot more popular, believe it or not, than 9/11. For whatever reason that is, I think it's a lot less scary. I think that it's been around, of course, a lot longer. There's many different reasons. But I've gone through a lot of, you know, I kind of jumped into that whole conspiracy world with an open mind, and I found a lot of things that have, you know, changed my mind about a lot of people in those various movements and or ufology, or as I call it, ufology. There's a lot of disinformation and false hope and stuff being sold, you know, to a lot of those people about, you know, the idea that aliens are going to come down and save us from everything. And there's a lot of these kind of ideas going around. And the kind of angle that I try to take from it all is I try to say, well, think like an alien would think, or like an alien scientist would think, or put yourself in this sort of extraterrestrial mindset where you're looking down at this primitive civilization on the verge or the cusp of becoming, you know, a star-faring space, you know, faring civilization. We're really like still burning fossil fuels for energy. We're polluting our earth. We're still using, you know, non-renewable technologies. Our society's not sustainable. It's not, it's headed on a path of destruction. And it's sort of, this whole mindset that, you know, we have to like think, bigger than ourselves and bigger than, you know, our living rooms and our Xboxes or our, you know,
stepping out of the busyness of life that can distract you from some of these bigger questions and sort of taking a fresh look as if you were coming to a new place. What type of society would you like
and
to create?
And sort of thinking to like the future, you know, of, you know, expressing interests and ideas that may seem like science fiction, even some of the topics that I talk about, you know, for example, anti-gravity. It's something totally unproven, totally against all known laws and stuff, but I still try to pursue, you know, maybe there's a technology out there, or I call it as a, you know, viable propulsion technology that we could use. Even stuff like this, you know, I entertain the ideas, because this might be technology that's 1,000 years more advanced than, you know, what we currently have. And I try to hold, you know, incorporate that whole mindset of, you know, think like an alien, think like someone who's more advanced and an advanced civilization, really.
But, you know, a separate from the different discussions of future technologies and where we could go in the future, he also covers a lot of cutting edge discoveries and sort of, you know, similar to what you'd see on TED lectures and stuff, the cutting edge of current technology, and sort of explains the scientific backbone of how it works and applications of what it can morph into for future discoveries. So trying to create an open dialogue of getting people interested into science, aware of the new discoveries and breakthroughs, and trying to get, you know, people talking from different areas that could get great ideas sort of flowing.
Absolutely. Well, I think that is a good approach to take because, of course, as I think, wasn't it Arthur C. Clarke that said any sufficiently advanced technology would be indistinguishable from magic? And I think it certainly does. I mean, every time we think and project out into the far future, I think that historians of the future will hopefully look back on our era of primitive fossil fuel technology as just hopelessly antiquated. But on the flip side of this, of course, we also see, I think, a lot of charlatanry when it comes to the type of free energy ideas and things that get passed around. And that's the thing that I find particularly frustrating, is because I have no doubt that there are all sorts of technologies that get suppressed. But then there's a lot of, charlatans that get promoted as misinformation to mislead people as well. And I've seen a lot of fads come and go in the last few years when I've been doing the Corbett Report website. So, I mean, it's difficult sometimes to weed through that. And that's what turns off a lot of people from that type of information.
Right. And I could name a few that I could think of offhand. And for instance, this Travolta Kesh or whatever from Iran, who's been recently, you know, like I know people that have worked for 25 years in the field of cold fusion technology and have given their entire lives to this career, like multiple different scientists who are like expert, you know, top in their field. And this guy to come along and say that he's discovered cold fusion, anti-gravity, you know, everything under the sun, all under one package. It's just like, you know, you're talking about individual fields that these other scientists have worked their entire lives on and have like, and I read his book and I'm just like, this is so non-scientific that it's just, I don't know how anyone could be fooled by this guy, but you know, yet there's no shortage of people, you know, sending him donation money and
hope
asking
is popular.
Him to come, paying him to come give lectures. And then the idea of hope, he's selling people hope, that's a popular thing. But it's a false hope. It's like the idea that free energy is going to come save us. And, I've written personal letters to Foster Gamble of, the Thrive movement there and sort of, you know, berated him for being so misled about this whole idea of free energy, And the idea that, you know, they're going to find this miracle that's just going to save everyone and that it's not, that's going to be this easy path to take. And, you know, even with the cold fusion technology, which I still believe is a viable, potentially viable technology. I recently attended lectures at MIT here, the IP cold fusion course in Cambridge. And I'm pretty convinced that, you know, what they're putting down, but still like, the technology is a long ways off from being able to build full-scale power plants and reactors. And it's going to take nanotechnology and engineering on a whole other level in order to bring that into reality. It's not just going to be in the form of, you know, a magnetic motor that you can put together with some plans you got on the internet for $20 and you know, $50 at Home Depot. It's not, you know, these people are being sold pipe dreams almost daily. And I think that, you know, indistinguishable from magic, yes, but people with the scientific tools to be able to dissect these sort of things and explain them to people, I think that's very much needed in these times, and I'm happy to fill that niche from where I can, you know, although it's impossible for me to go and give a review of every single thousand different invention out there. You know, you'd have to build every single one and prove them wrong individually. And no, that's really not necessary. It's if you really educate people about how energy works and, you know, how it's stored and the technical difficulties of that, because I think and giving people access to better projects and programs, you know, like, because there's so much out there to mislead them with that, like you mentioned, the free energy movement and everything else.
And the difference between, just really quick, free energy being non-costly energy versus free energy being energy extracted from the environment without, you know, following the laws of physics, are two separate things that kind of get blurred together. And a lot of times what they're saying is, you know, like solar panels, once you pay them off, you have free energy.
But that takes maintenance.
And maintenance. Like there's, you know, there's all these other things that sort of go around it. That's
the thing is, there's no asterisk. Free tickets. Anyone trying to sell you something for free is lying to you, basically, you know.
Right. Perpetual motion machines and breaking the second law of thermodynamics and other such promises are generally going to be pockets full of hope. And I can understand exactly why that appeals to a lot of people. And I can also understand from a layman's perspective, myself only ever having taken introductory physics at university, it is bewildering sometimes to sort through this when you're coming at it from the outside and trying to determine what is reliable and what isn't. What advice would you give to people who are curious but incredulous about what you're saying as well as what other people are saying? How do they sort through these contradictions?
It can be very difficult without, you know, a firm understanding of the, you know, basic concepts behind things. One of the most popular ones I see is the idea of magnetic free energy. And magnetic fields don't do any work ever. They're incapable of doing work. You're just moving from one potential to another, and the energy that you put in to get to travel to, or get back, is always going to be equal to, you know, whatever you put in. And there's no way to jump across those magnetic field lines to get to a lower potential. And even if you bend it around, they're just getting closer together. So you have to jump, over more, the same number of them to go the same distance. There's no way around it. The vector mechanics is the way to understand it. That's the math that they use to understand the magnetic field. And if, you know, you can learn that, then maybe, you know, you could have some ground to stand on to really talk about, you know, magnetism or say things about magnetism. But without that, I think you're going to have a real hard time convincing the scientific community or anyone else that your invention actually works. Things I would look for is energy harvesting devices. And also there's things like the XPRIZE, where they have competitions for, you know, these types of things. And if you have something, go bring it to them. And if it's real, then you'll get it tested by, you know, experts at an event, you know. But if it's not, which most of the time it isn't, then you're not going to have a very good time trying to convince some of those people. But you're talking about people that are experts in energy in these fields, and they're not, you know, they're not something that's easy that you can just, you know, approach with the high school level physics understanding or anything. Even with the bachelor's degree in physics, like I have, some of this stuff requires immense technical knowledge and even specific areas of energy and alternative energies can, be an endless area of study or pursuit, you know, the engineering and mechanics and all types of things that you, it's a really,
it could be a career for the, you know, you die.
A career till you die. Anyone, wind energy, solar, you name it.
Right. Well, that's exactly right. And of course, this is not just some sort of, you know, intellectual pursuit. This is something that very much pertains to the future of the human civilization, really. And case in point of that, of course, happening right here in Japan, when the shutdown of the nuclear reactors that we saw last year, two of them now back online, and they're planning to slowly start turning them back on. But of course, Japan is in that political moment where it's fading and closing very quickly, but there is still the possibility that they could try to seek out some different ways of powering this isolated island nation. And I did talk about that on the podcast before, talking about some of the other ideas. Geothermal, of course, an incredible amount of that here that has yet to be tapped. Also, other things like tidal power coming online with various research projects taking place off the coast of Scotland and other places right now, and even ideas like thorium nuclear reactors. Why don't you talk about what you think it might be some of the more promising ways of generating electricity in the future?
Well, there's all different aspects. The whole thing right here in Boston with Cape Wind going on and all the money being thrown at that project to try and shut down all the windmills they were going to put in right off Cape Cod. And lots of wealthy people jumping in to protest that for, you know, who knows, a variety of different reasons, and some more legitimate than others. But I don't know, we're going to have to pursue every avenue we can, because there's only... the thing is, Germany's already doing that in some sense, but it's the thing is that we're not going to want to deal with the consequences if we don't prepare now. You know, we have to use whatever works. I mean, there are technologies that are going to get better and they're going to come along. But right now we have to go with, you know, what's proven and what's proven to work, and start building something, putting something in place to displace our current, you know, consumption and demand for oil and petroleum. That industry is just booming. And if you understand the exponential, the law of exponentials, I mean, we used more oil in the past 10 years than we used in the entire history before that. And it's just accelerating every 10 years. It's just gets more like that, you know?
We talk about the banking connection.
And there's not just that, but there's a huge banking connection with oil. And you look up the entire history of the Bilderberg Group. It was basically founded on these oil agreements between these bankers.
And in many ways, to connect to the Federal Reserve, one thing that I think is really important to talk about is the people who are familiar with the Federal Reserve understand how they're able to print money they don't have and lend out 90% over and over again, 90% of the 90%. They're able to expand their money supply. What it does is it devalues the value of the currency, which is the U.S. dollar, and they usually balance it out with inflation. So they say it's not that we devalued your currency, you just need more of the same money to buy the same thing. And another way that they balance that out is with the petrodollar. When the U.S. dollar is hurting, if other countries have to buy U.S. dollars for their oil and they're paying twice as much for the same amount of oil, they're bringing a lot of currency, a lot of value into the U.S. dollar that wouldn't be there separate from oil. And kind of interesting, prior to going into Iraq half a year before, Iraq, Iran, and North Korea were going to switch off the U.S. dollar to the euro for all oil trades.
Even Gaddafi and
Gaddafi was going to switch over to the gold standard. We're kind of operating in economic bubbles right now, and part of how they keep it afloat is by making sure that oil revenue routes through our currency, and countries who threaten that political structure seem to be get occupied to a point where they're not able to have sovereignty to make that decision.
Right.
They get, of course, part of that petrodollar deal is that the Saudis and others have to bank their money in the U.S. banks, which again also puts it right into the system.
Thing. If you go back to all the money they've made, correct me if I'm wrong, but during the development in the 70s of a lot of the oil industries in the Middle East, a lot of it was corporations that would come in, sort of develop it with the agreement that the profits from it would be invested into U.S. bonds. And they were able to sort of say that, hey, we're giving you this gift, but they're kind of extracting the money the whole time, printing more money than they have of that value of their bonds, and basically diluting their bonds and extracting all the money that those people should have been storing. It's a very interesting picture of sort of the oil politics of what's going on. But the thing with Tesla's battle with J.P. Morgan, when he was looking for different alternatives to energy, J.P. Morgan said he wouldn't fund anything he couldn't put a meter on. So there's this connection between banking infrastructures balancing their currency values by ensuring that we stay on raw resources that can be monopolized and jacked up in profit.
That's why I always explain the best way to overcome all this system is through alternative energies and through cutting off the oil is one of the main pillars of power structure. And if the only way to get around that is, kicking oil and using alternative energies, renewable energies.
I think countries are kind of in a tough grid where if they can't get energy, you can't really produce an economy as a country. So for them to have this sort of gatekeeping position over what price it is for energy and whose currency you have to support in order to get that energy, it keeps the United States or the elites in the United States propped up just so other countries can get by or to get the small, whatever oil, types of energy they're getting. It's
Well, that was the first.
It's a strong arm technique almost.
It was the first part of the takeover process that John Perkins outlined in Economic Hitman. Build him a power plant, number one.
Exactly, and right. And obviously we see how that is sort of central to the economy. The backbone of the economy is the energy infrastructure, which is constructed around the petrodollar hegemon, which has existed since the 1970s. And of course, petroleum has been the core energy for the last 100+ years. So it has been this construction, and all people have to do is look at the history of the Rockefeller family, how they went from oil to banking to basically oligarchical control. And that's not, I think, just a historical happenstance. I think there's a reason behind that. But given that trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars of economic transactions are based on this paradigm, and there's entire political dynasties, and the control of the oligarchy rests on this, I think it's obvious we're not going to be able to change this over without a fundamental shift in perception of general consciousness about this issue and what's behind it. So on that front, where do you see things happening from here to actually enable the space for those types of technologies to emerge?
This is the most important issue in our current society right now. It's everything, energy and the way it affects money and money supplies, I think, is number one. And
also information getting out as well, you know, exposing these type of things to people.
Just the information of it. I think I don't know where it's going to go, but I want to be instrumental in making it happen. I know that.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many different ways to kind of answer that. But I think one of the most important things is just sort of creating a dialogue, because it's going to be a hard thing to sort of explain the corporate corruption through the mainstream media, whose revenue comes from advertising firms that represent those same corporations. I mean, I would argue that a majority of censorship, you don't even need some person at the top of the pyramid to say, this is what you don't cover, you do cover. They don't talk about corporate corruption. They have a blind eye to their money streams because that is their clientele. And if they speak bad about their clientele, future, you know, advertisers will not want to work with them. It's the same way with news reporting agencies. If they speak bad about what the government's doing, they'll lose access to information early and other stuff. You know, they play the game to allow their money stream to continue, whatever it is. And a lot of this structure is people through interdependence. You know, like a lot of these corporations, they may not understand the end game of loss of sovereignty and supranational institutions and sort of where everything's moving, but they'll protect the economic banking substructure every step of the way so that their business doesn't collapse and so that their infrastructure stays intact. Right. And really all they need to know is the environment that they're protecting themselves in, not really where it's going.
Those are the better elements of a conspiracy, which drives these people to be part of it or engage in it. And it's not like, you have like all these other people out there saying like, oh, it's just because they're the embodiment of Satan or they're pure evil is why they're doing all this.
You're fighting against. I mean, that's just it's a symbolic representation of sort of what it's supposed to be. But, you know, in many ways, the whole reptilian and all this other stuff to sort of distract people from actual human beings who are setting up policy, who have been documented to carry out banking changes. I mean, it's very well recorded throughout history. The power players, the positions in history, their influence of media, their influence of politics. It's right. Very, I mean, if you spend the time, it's there. And a lot of these alternatives of what we consider disinformation.
Like, dismantle the actual pyramid. Don't just focus on the symbology of, you know, the symbol, you know, like go look into it. The devil's in the details.
And I mean, if you want to get into some of these other things, like the way I see Skull and Bones, I don't see Skull and Bones as a society that really worships this sort of notion of Satan, or maybe some of them believe they do. I have no idea, but it's a breeding ground for cronies. It's a cronyism breeding ground for the elite to create a brotherhood between elite who can be tapped into political positions and carry on the ideals and the agendas of the elite. And in many ways, they kind of go through these conditioning trainings of sacrificing the public, for their goal. And it's these sort of metaphors for what they're doing in general.
But the big thing is to tap the elite, the best of the Ivy League schools, the smartest of the smartest, and tap those people into these positions of power before they can, you know, join up with people like us. And
there is something to the death symbology that surrounds so many of these societies as well. I mean, it's not only Skull and Bones, but of course the Freemasons and all of these groups have these oaths that you have to take on penalty of death that you will never portray, to spill the secret. And I think we can obviously see, not only trace historically, but see generally the idea of the secret societies of old transforming into the intelligence agencies of now. I mean, the CIA was founded from Skull and Bones, and I think there's a reason behind that type of connection.
Absolutely. Right. You know,
secrecy.
In many ways, they've sort of evolved. Like when people talk about Freemasons, you know, they didn't have women in Freemasons. If you look a lot of the There's a lot of power players in the political sphere who are female, who are part of the corporate sphere, part of the Bilderberg sphere, or the media, or the, you know, there's a lot of powerful people outside of sort of the classifications of the term Illuminati, or as is in reference to banking, or the term, you know, Freemasons. Even though they had a huge influence over the construction of this country, it sort of merged into this globalized owning class structure that supports the infrastructure of banks and economic and trade for so many countries that those countries will protect that first in order to protect themselves. A really good example, one of the classes I took at Amherst College, they looked in 1994 at the amount of global capital movement of money from the multinational corporations versus small businesses worldwide. So multinational would be a company who operates in different countries, sells in different countries as different retail stores. It's spread out wherever it wants to operate throughout the world. They have a shareholder base wherever profits come from any of those octopus arms. It pays off the employees, you know, the management, and then whatever's left over usually goes up to the shareholders. They found in 1994, in one day, the multinationals moved $7 trillion, put options, stocks, goods, just movement of capital in general. They compared it to small businesses worldwide in a year, $4 trillion a year. It's almost a $2,000 trillion difference in a lot of it is put options and derivatives and money that doesn't even exist. But the amount of capital that's moving from the multinationals is more than what any country can do with their own GDP, their own influence over their own country's economy. And what starts happening is you get these political actors in each country who are sort of tapped into political roles. And what they do is they protect the global multinational sphere first, because all the other countries are at the point where they're dependent on that sphere staying alive for their capital to flow through their countries. And the public hasn't really been let in on this. I think a lot of the international battles that you're seeing right now, nation state versus nation state, lead to unions or sort of this loss of sovereignty in the end structure. They're kind of pitting them against each other to stack up debt on both sides, like we've seen throughout time, which removes their ability to question the global economic system that's currently in power. When countries are in debt to it, it's sort of what happened to third world countries over the past 20 years. They lose their political sovereignty to say no or want to do something different than the interests of the IMF or these supranational institutions.
I would say since the end of the Second World War, at the very least, the idea of nation states has been more of a propaganda tool than an actual on-the-ground reality. And it's just used as in sort of jingoistic rhetoric to get people to rally around flags to fight for causes that don't serve them. But I think absolutely it's an international interlocking grid of plutocrats who rule from generally from behind the curtains. But all of this leads to the conclusion that the change is not going to happen within that system. It can only be constructed from around and outside of that system. And we've touched a little bit on this. I mean, for example, even just the distribution of information that would help people to be able to make the decisions that would generate that change is completely controlled within that paradigm through the corporate media and even a lot of the alternative media that is foundation funded, etc., that ties back to the same people. So the obvious answer to this is the technology of things like the internet, which actually do allow for instantaneous global worldwide communication from individuals to individuals that is transforming our society and has that potential to start to construct an alternative. Where do you first of all, do you think that is the paradigm that we have to be looking at? And secondly, how do we protect that from the inevitable attacks that are already coming and will no doubt increase in the future?
Yeah,
we always
discuss that the internet's the most important gateway of, you know, to have this dialogue. Every other form of media has a gatekeeper at the top, whether it's a magazine or a radio or a TV show. You have a chief editor who says yay or nay or whether things get put on. And what happens is if you have a reporter who wants to rock the boat and cover the hard questions, and he gets rejected 5 times in a row, he realizes he's going to lose his job unless he caters to the type of stories that they are looking for. And it's the way they weed out sort of the subversion inside of the media and keep the people who are just faces that can read a teleprompter very effectively and be...
I definitely think the internet is number one in our transformation process. And the thing is that there has to be a transformation process to begin with. We can no longer, I don't think anyone could reasonably argue that we could continue on the path that we're headed. And there's a lot of people talking about, you know, what can come out of that catalyst for change. And there's a lot of scary things too, like these New World Order scenarios, 1984 style police state, you know, what is the world going to change into? And I try to tell people, you know, and convince them that we have more control over this than, you know, we would think.
Than ever in history,
more so than ever before.
In the 80s, the joke we make is if we were in the 80s and we needed to spread 9/11 videos, we'd be sitting with, VCRs and just sitting there for hours degrading the quality of it just to please watch this, put it in your V8. I mean, the ability, he'll make a video. And Jeremy says, you know, I give lectures while I brush my teeth. I give lectures while I'm sleeping. While I'm out at school, I'm giving lectures because it's on demand. And, you know, same thing with you.
It can go and look up whatever, whenever, and it's on demand. And I think that that's the most important tool, even though that, you know, all the information on the internet's content created by humans, for humans, through the lens of a human, with all the imperfections and mistakes that go with that. But at the same time, there is good information on the internet. There is a lot more of bad information, I will admit, more than half. But
and you should always check your sources. If you're reading a book that doesn't have sources where you can verify the information, you know, during the McCarthyism era and stuff like that, I'm sure there's a lot of stuff that was just as inaccurate as some of the stuff you'll find on the internet. I mean, the most important thing is being able to cross-reference sources, which is what the internet allows you to do, versus having one media outlet that you trust.
Right. And take, you'll notice, you know, newspapers were pretty much the last of the internet websites to actually take on the practice of linking to source documents. And they're starting to do that more and more now that they can't get away with not doing that. But I think they just tipped their hand as to their practices. But I mean, isn't the parallel so perfect there with the Homeland Security police state? We will protect you from the terrorists by taking away all your choice and all your freedoms. Well, we'll protect you from the bad information by taking away your ability to access that information directly. It's the same paradigm.
Yeah, I think what they need to do is they get people offended. If you can somehow get people offended, like for instance, like if you're saying, I want you to take another look at 9/11, and somebody who maybe has emotional connection to it might get very angry about that. They kind of play on this initial emotional response, and then what they'll try to get people to do is come to a conclusion before they research it. So it's either a subjective assumption of, oh, they're just a loony, you know, they're just a conspiracy theorist, what that means to me, or they probably think everything is a conspiracy, or they'll come to some realization or some conclusion in their head that allows them to say, I'm okay with the official story without researching further. You know, almost every trick you see, because
it could be,
this is what you'll see through most censorship. Because once you start looking at the hard questions in 9/11, it's pretty hard to not say, well, you know, there's something really interesting that we should look into with this, because there's a lot going on that's very disturbing. But, you know, you don't get into those conversations if you say that guy's just crazy, I don't need to listen to him.
To reject it before they reach that realization, before they can even look at the information, you want them to have a conclusion or a reaction that's pre-programmed before that even happens. And
so, yeah, I mean, things like that, I always try to get them to relate to something else in their life. If they made that same way of analyzing things and dealing with it, what their outcome would have been with, like with their children or with, you know, it's just like, why would you not give that same type of analytical insight to one of the most important events of our history, leading into police states and surveillance societies and all these losses of freedoms and stuff? You know, take a look at all these things that are disappearing. All we're asking is just to take another look at this event that was the catalyst to allow all these things to happen and say, You know, instead of just saying, okay, I'm okay with the loss of all these freedoms that this country's based on, let's take another look at why they're doing it. Are you okay with at least that?
Right.
Or I think one of the most effective introductions to talk about 9/11 that we've kind of developed through all the ones that we've tried is bringing up the 9/11 victim family members who had questions that weren't answered and were, you know,
well, it's using their emotional appeals back at them because.
But I mean, that's the initial emotional response a lot of people have is to them. And just bringing up that there's a big group of the family members who had these questions who weren't answered. And all that we're asking is that these members' questions be heard. And, you know, are you against the members of family members who died, these questions being heard? Even if, you know, some of the people aren't into the truth stuff and didn't look into these harder questions. You know, these are family members who lost members. Are you really against, you know, if somebody doesn't want to hear it, you know, are you really against
the internet? You wouldn't even be able to get that message out there. You wouldn't even have a voice or a platform to, you know, get this out. And I'm glad I have a YouTube channel, like, with a lot of subscribers. Now I can put a video online and get seen by all these people.
And know that you're getting seen
and know
not feeling isolated.
The entire stadium of people will watch that video before, you know, like the end of the month, or, you know, like your video that you did on 9/11. And sometimes it's like that. You make this one video you think is just kind of funny. And then all of a sudden it's like, wow, you know, you get a million views on it. You're like, wow, this is really going to blow up into something big. Kind of like my 9/11 conspiracy solved video. I was like, that's got like 250,000 views and it was only up for a couple months. And I was just like, wow, this is like really making some waves. And all I can say is that, you know, you never can tell what's going to take off or when it's going to take off and how it all is going to work. But, without the internet, we're not going to have any of that. And I think
that might be a good place to connect back in with the audience, because that's something that I've heard and experienced myself from every single alternative media producer I've ever talked to, is that you really never, ever know what's going to take off and what doesn't. So I think the point to that is just keep trying and keep plugging away and keep doing it and keep exposing the truth and keep working towards what you believe in, and it will have an effect. And I think that that's the type of message that people need to take to heart, because a lot of people might dip their toe in the water of the trying to spread this information and get discouraged at the first sign of lack of success. So
yeah, and what's coming up is that the people you reach, it's so much further than what you actually get a feedback of what you reach.
You will never know.
You reach one person who will talk to another. Like, for instance, many years ago, I handed out 9/11 videos.
Too. You never know who's watching that video. It could be like some movie star in Hollywood or someone who's going to, you know, now come out.
I have a perfect story for that. In college, I used to make these 9/11 videos called the 9/11 Total Wake Up CD. And it was just a compilation of good documentary sort of explaining it. And it had the Killtown website. I stripped all the sort of disinfo out of it and kept just the meat stuff. I spent like a month going through that whole thing. There was thousands and thousands of them. So I put that on the disc and I was just handing these out. I'd go to school and go to the library and just put a stack of them every morning, and they disappear by the end of the day. One of those went out and made its way to Jeremy.
Yeah.
Just happened to get to him.
That's what started me into all
this. That's what got him into research. I mean, he took it leaps and bounds beyond what I ever did with it. But that was just one of the, you know, many discs that I gave out, and exponentially, look how many people he's influenced, who maybe influenced other people, and
back. You know, and I didn't even know stuff like this is going on right now. It could even be going on. You don't even know about it.
But it helps with motivation, because it can be really discouraging.
You put out a lot of videos.
This.
You put a lot of work and time into doing your research and banging your head against the wall sometimes, where you're just like, you know, trying to figure something out, and then all of a sudden it's like it will click or maybe it doesn't click and you just put something out anyway. You know, it's not easy what we have to do and the amount of crap that you have to sort of sift through and the amount of time it takes to go through that. And it's not easy. Sometimes it's easy to get discouraged, but at the end of the day, it's, you're reaching large numbers of people. You never know who's going to watch your video. Anyone could click on it and you never know. It could just be the story or the right presentation that takes it to the next level. I mean, I released that video. I got guys that contacted me. He said he's been calling up like Marsha McLennan and all these other companies and like getting, inquiring, recording them on the phone and like grilling him about all this different stuff because he watched my video and he's like got all mad about it. You know, it's like
excellent. Well, that is good to hear. I mean, it's ripples in a pond, and we don't know where those ripples are going to end up or how they're going to affect the water, but we know they are having some effect. So, unfortunately, I have to run along to another interview. But is there any final thoughts you'd like to leave the audience with here about what we've talked about today?
Do your own research.
Yeah, that's the best thing. Research implies researching. It means just constant effort of researching and
picking apart your arguments that may have been incorrect. I think one of the most important things, one of our philosophies is accuracy over ego. Yeah. Where it's you know, even if I have a stance on something, if somebody presents enough evidence where they've convinced me that something else makes more sense, why should I'd be offended or scared, you know, it's all
or
about
try to defend my position just because I don't want to be perceived as being wrong or
something. It's all about having the most effective research that we can to get to the bottom of these things. And the way that we can do that is with humility and really analyzing ourselves to strengthen the arguments as much as possible.
One message I'll leave you guys with, it's about sharpening the spear at this point. We have a massive amount of information. We have so much stuff that's come out over the past few years. We just need to sharpen the spear now and drive it full force through this beast's heart.
Strip out the circumstantial. Really focus on the stuff where there's no – you
find
can't get around
the,
it.
Find all the things that you could avoid saying, you know, the things that you don't really – that don't really contribute to your argument.
Or could turn people off. Like, you know, there's certain things where you might have somebody totally convinced because you presented very good stuff, and then you bring up one thing of –
oh, by the way,
what happened with the plane to the Pentagon, you know, if the plane didn't hit, then we're, you know, you can have these things that are, they may not be solved yet, but we have all this other evidence that proves without a doubt that it is such. So to get kind of caught up in those or have people hold their judgment because of these type of things can sort of, I think we need to figure out the strongest scientific and sort of.
James, thanks for taking your time to do this with us and getting our message out there. And,
well, I appreciate it. And for people out there, once again, it's Jeremy and Matt, alienscientist.com, youtube.com/alienscientist. Are there any other places people should be going for your work, or does that cover it?
That's pretty much it.
All right, excellent. Well, I hope people will check into it. The links will be in the show notes for the interview, as always. So, Jeremy, Matt, thank you for your time.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you. Have a great day.